The Iowa Arts Showcase is Iowa Public Radio's monthly performing arts program devoted to Iowa's not-for-profit arts and cultural organizations. I'm Jacqueline Hallbloom. For November, we'll pick the Opera America President's Brain. We'll investigate a special concert showcasing the music of World War I and artifacts from the war to end all wars. We'll delve into the lore and legend of Paganini and Robert Johnson through the eyes and artwork of Iowa's own Gary Kelly. And we'll celebrate with Trio 826 as they present a new release and prepare for their November residency program. That's all ahead on Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase. Thanks for joining us.
We don't really do this to make money. We all have other jobs. I teach here at the university, and I also teach for the UNI Suzuki School. I have a bunch of students outside of the university. And Hannah is in the New York City Ballet Orchestra, and she also plays with the Quad City Symphony. She's principal cellist of that orchestra as well. So she splits her time between New York and Iowa. And Susanna is on the faculty at Virginia Commonwealth University. So this trio project is really kind of a labor of love. We enjoy playing together, and it's important to us to bring music to our community.
Trio 826 is Julia Bullard. This month, Trio 826 is presenting a residency program at the Hearst Center for the Arts. Three friends, violinist Susanna Klein, cellist Hannah Holman, and violist Julia Bullard, join forces to form the ensemble.
It was in January of 2011 that the three of us started playing together, mostly just for fun, and then it kind of turned into a thing.
And this thing is now called the Trio 826, and how did it get this unusual name?
We needed a name in a hurry. We were presenting at a conference, and we hadn't really thought about giving ourselves a name at that point. And Hannah and Susanna were talking on the phone, and one of them Googled the mileage from Iowa City to Richmond, and it was 826 miles. And so we became Trio 826 because somebody has to travel at least that far for us to actually play together.
Tell us just a little bit of the musical background of Susanna and Hannah and yourself.
I did my undergraduate work in Philadelphia at Temple University. I actually started studying with Joseph DePasquale before I went to Temple. I was at the Philadelphia College of Performing Arts and transferred to Temple to study with Emmanuel Vardy. And I had other fabulous teachers there as well, including Sidney Curtis, who was assistant principal of the Philadelphia Orchestra. And then I did my doctoral studies at the University of Georgia in Athens. And Hannah has studied at the New England Conservatory. She did her master's there, and she also did some study for a while at Eastman and then at Michigan State. And Susanna studied actually at the school that she's now a faculty member at Virginia Commonwealth University, and she did her master's degree in Boston with the very famous violinist Roman Totenberg, who, if you are an NPR listener, you know Nina Totenberg, so keeping it in the family there. So they're both fabulous players and really great people. We have a lot of fun working together.
So you've just done this incredible CD, and you're also doing a residency, and you're going to have a CD party. So tell us all about all the cool things that you have coming up here in November.
We always try to do something that's educational, that works with either students in the university setting or out in the public schools, or both. And we also like to try to play in places that you might not expect to hear a classical chamber music performance, just to draw in new kinds of audiences and also kind of get rid of the perception that chamber music is something that's only for a certain kind of person or just for the elite, or you have to know something about music to enjoy chamber music. We'd like to break down those barriers and try to bring music to everybody. So starting on November 8th, we have outreach performances all over Waterloo and Cedar Falls communities. Our first one is on November 8th at 10:30 in the morning, and it'll be at the Western Home Chapel in Cedar Falls. And then on November 9th, we have a little event at the Hearst Center for Preschoolers, which will be really fun. It's called Musical Messy Mornings. And we'll have a chamber music class that same day, and we'll be focusing in that class, it's for adults, on music as a form of communication. And then in the evening on Wednesday the 9th, we will have cocktails and chamber music at the Octopus on College Hill. So that should be another really fun way to bring some music into an unusual space. And then on Thursday, we do some school outreach. We'll be at schools both in Cedar Falls and Waterloo. And then in the evening on Thursday, we have a performance at Cup of Joe in Cedar Falls. So then on Friday, the 11th of November, we have a noon concert at the Hearst Center. And that will be a concert that will also feature students from the University of Northern Iowa School of Music, where I'm on the faculty. And there will also be a student ensemble that will play a piece on that same concert. We'll also play a couple of pieces by ourselves. And then our CD release concert is that evening at 7 o'clock at the Hearst. And it's a free concert, and there will be a reception at the end, and we will offer our CDs at a special price for people attending the concert. And we'll play music from the CD, but we'll also play some other things as well. We're going to play a Beethoven trio on the first half.
Now, you were saying that not only are you going to be doing classical music, but Susanna's husband has made some great arrangements for you as well.
Yeah, Susanna's husband, John Wynn, is a fabulous jazz and popular musician. He plays saxophone, he sings, he plays keyboards, and he does a lot of arranging and writing his own music. And a couple of years ago, we did a residency here at UNI that was focused on music of the Holocaust. And for that particular set of concerts, John actually arranged some music for us from the movie 12 Years a Slave. So we'll be playing that, and then we'll be playing some other things that were written for us by other people, including some of my colleagues at UNI. Two of the pieces on our CD are brand new pieces that were written for the trio. The first of them is by Rebecca Burkhart. It's a piece called Holidays. It's actually one movement of what will be a three-movement piece that's all based on different blues singers. And this one, if you can guess from the title, Holidays, is actually based on music of Billie Holiday. And it's a really fun piece. We love playing it. So we're excited to share that. And one of the first things that we actually learned as a trio is a piece by my colleague Bob Washit here from UNI. It's a really fun Latin-influenced piece, and it's called Sonando. We've played that a lot, and we never get tired of playing it. And audiences never seem to get tired of hearing it either. If we do an outreach concert and there's someone there that's heard the trio, they will inevitably ask me, "Are you guys going to play Sonando?" And so we include it a lot as an encore, but it'll definitely make an appearance on that concert at the Hearst.
Tell us about some of the other works that you have on your disc.
Usually you think of a string trio concert and you're thinking you're going to hear these really big, long, complicated pieces like the Beethoven trio that we're going to play on that concert. And we love playing those pieces, but our first concert together was kind of a workshop kind of performance where we talked a lot with audiences about what they want to hear. We were all really thinking a lot at that time about what's the future of music? What are we doing and why are we doing it and how can we make this art form more accessible to more people? And one of the things we found is finding more variety and pieces that speak to people and catch their interest and keep their interest and maybe aren't these long masterworks, so that really everybody in the audience could find something that spoke directly to them. So that's kind of how we came up with this CD that's entirely composed of these shorter pieces. The longest piece on the CD is only about 12 minutes long, and that is a Schubert string trio in one movement. And that's another first piece for us. That was one of the very first things that we started learning as a trio. And it's a great opener, we thought, for the CD. And of course, the two pieces that I already mentioned by Becky Burkhart and Bob Washit are on there. The other pieces include string trio by Borodin that was actually originally written for two violins and cello, but I like stealing violin music as a violist. And the next piece on the disc is a piece called Dance or Tanek by Hans Krause. And Krause was a composer that we discovered when we were doing research for our residency that was based on music of the Holocaust. He was a composer who actually perished in a concentration camp, but he left behind some fantastic music, and this is a piece that we really enjoy. There's an intermezzo by Kodály. He was a good friend of Bartók. Kodály wrote this wonderful single movement piece for trio, and it's really beautiful. It's very evocative. It has lots of kind of Hungarian flavor, but it's also very melodic, and we enjoy playing that one a lot. The next one is called Obad, and that's by George Enescu, and it's very beautiful, and at the end, there's kind of a fun section where the viola is actually playing the Hungarian national anthem. It makes a little appearance there. The next piece on the disc is probably my favorite, this Bach organ trio. String trios weren't really a thing yet when Bach was alive, but this organ trio, which is really for the different manuals of the organ, it turns out that these parts are in the perfect range for a string trio. And we rather think that Bach would have approved of this idea. The next piece is a wonderful little trio by Richard Strauss. Strauss is not exactly somebody that you necessarily would think of when you think of chamber music, but he did write some chamber music, and this little trio is actually quite lovely. It has a subtitle in Bavarian, and our violinist, Susanna, was actually born in Germany. She's a fluent native German speaker, and it's actually a really strange, you know, slightly different dialect, and she actually had to consult the librarian at VCU and do some research to figure out what this title translates to, and very loosely, it translates to My Girl is Mad at Me. The Borodin Trio also has a subtitle. The title is in Russian, of course, and one of my colleagues is Russian and has told me that it basically translates to What Have You Done to Me? It's all very tragic. So it's kind of interesting that there were two pieces on the CD with very programmatic titles that we had to do a little research about.
Trio 826's violist, Julia Bullard. Trio 826's CD release concert and reception is set at 7 p.m. on Friday, November 11th at the Hearst Center for the Arts in Cedar Falls. For more details, see thehearst.com or go to trio826.com. All of the trio's events are free and open to the public. The Messy Mornings for Preschoolers does require pre-registration. Just ahead, we'll explore the second music series at Salisbury House that links the music of World War I with artifacts on loan from Iowa's Gold Star Military Museum. We'll get the lowdown from the artist himself on Giving the Devil His Due, The Art of Gary Kelly. And we'll hear how opera in Iowa is hitting a high note. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase.
I just hope people realize that opera is the most universal way to depict and to understand people and the human condition, and to be in a theater while these universal emotions are being expressed on stage, where the music expands the intensity beyond the words. The music amplifies the emotional experience way beyond what language does. And that even if some of the characters are historical in nature, their emotions are very contemporary. And that tickets to performances are available at very, very reasonable prices. That going to the opera doesn't mean that you have to get dressed up. You can go as you are and enjoy it and feel welcomed in the opera house. That there are new works being developed that express American stories in contemporary musical and theatrical terms. It's a very vital, current art form. It's a multimedia art form in a multimedia world. And if people enjoy music videos, which are a short form pop version of opera, opera can really speak to a deep emotional level in a multimedia way. It's a very contemporary and deep universal experience.
Mark Skorka, the president of Opera America. The Cedar Rapids Opera Theater invited Mark Skorka to Iowa. Mark caught the opera bug early from his grandparents. He loved watching their huge collection of 78 RPM opera recordings whizzing around the turntable. The opera's music, the stories, and the sound captivated him.
I was born and brought up in New York, and I went away to college. And my freshman first month, I wrote to the Metropolitan Opera, the general manager, and said, during my winter break, I'd like to volunteer for the opera company. And a week later or so, I had a letter back saying, we'd love to see you at your next holiday back in New York. And the rest is history. My entire college career, I spent 7 months a year at college and 5 months a year at the Metropolitan Opera, learning all kinds of things. I've never done anything but opera.
Tell us a little bit about Opera America and why it's so important.
Opera America is the umbrella organization for the opera industry. All of the professional opera companies, the universities and conservatories, the various businesses that provide services to opera companies, as well as administrators, artists, trustees, board members of opera companies are members of Opera America. And like any umbrella organization, we provide professional development activities, research, advocacy. Our main office is in New York, but we have an office in Washington. And we give out almost $750,000 a year in grants to opera companies in support of the creation of new work, creative audience building programs, education programs. We have a whole program to help strengthen boards. We call it the National Trustee Forum. So in every way, we try to advocate for opera to overcome some of the misplaced negative stereotypes and to communicate the fact that opera is a thriving multimedia art form in the multimedia world we live in.
Well, rumor has it that you have been really instrumental in expanding the horizons of Opera America.
I've been president of Opera America for 26 years now, and it was a smaller organization back in 1990 when I took it over. Most recently, in the fall of 2012, we opened the National Opera Center, which in New York City, we have a 25,000 square foot facility, and it has a recital hall that's used for auditions all the time, full recording studio, so singers are making CDs for auditions. We have readings of new works, rehearsals, singers are there to take lessons and coachings. Altogether, last year we had over 75,000 people come through the Opera Center to do the essential work of training, performing, rehearsing opera. So it's really the heart of the opera industry in New York City. And you think, well, my goodness, there's so much space in New York. How can they not have had an opera center? But on the other hand, real estate is so expensive that there just wasn't a dedicated space for opera. And many of our opera companies that fly to New York annually, twice a year to audition young singers, they would do so in church basements and unheated lofts and spaces that were completely inappropriate to hearing opera singers. So we decided to take that on, and it was a project of a few years of design and planning and fundraising until we finally opened it. But it is bursting at the seams. We regret that there are people we have to turn away almost every day because we are so fully booked with singers and teachers, coaches, composers, and librettists doing the work.
You just mentioned composers, and that has been a real thing for you with doing commissions and collaborations. Tell us a little bit about your mission in this area.
This has been a core commitment from even before the time that I joined the organization. In the mid-1980s, opera leaders had to admit that opera was at risk, that it would become a 19th century museum art form unless there were American operas that talked about American stories in more contemporary musical and theatrical terms. So we began to focus on that in the mid-1980s, and thanks to some support from a few wonderful foundations, we began to make grants to opera companies on a competitive basis with an arm's length panel to support the commissioning and production of new American opera. Doing opera at all is a very expensive endeavor. New opera is particularly expensive because you have the costs of the commission, all the sets and costumes have to be new, there have to be more rehearsals because no one knows the music. So doing new opera is intrinsically expensive, and our grants helped level the playing field so that some of the risk, the financial risk of doing new work, would be mitigated. And after years of various foundations supporting us, starting in the year 2000, we began to build our own endowment called the Opera Fund. And it is the income from that endowment, which is a growing endowment, that enables us to make our grants today. So over the years, we've given out over $13 million in these workshop grants, development grants, production grants for new American opera. And today, 30 years after those meetings, there is a bona fide, rich, varied American opera repertoire. And we are thrilled that almost every opera company in the country, whether it's yearly, every other year, they're doing new American opera.
How is technology helping you, and how has technology changed the opera scene?
Well, technology has always been a force in opera. The first theaters where you could dim the lights were opera houses in the 19th century. Suddenly gas could be dimmed and you could finally have a dark theater and look at the stage. Then you think about the beginning of the record industry. And I think there should be a book written about the intersection of Caruso, Puccini, and RCA Victor. Because it was kind of, to use modern terminology going back more than a century, it was the killer app, that you had this new recording industry and you had a superstar Enrico Caruso tenor. Now, one could ask, was he a superstar because of the recording industry, or was he a superstar on his own? You had the contemporary composer at the time, Puccini, and his operas were tremendous popular success combined with a great popular singer, and suddenly people could listen to opera at home. Then radio. And the Metropolitan Opera radio broadcasts made opera accessible now for 75 years or more. Finally, telecasts in the 1970s on a regular basis. And now we have live streams of opera performances. We have transmissions from opera houses to sports stadiums in Dallas and San Francisco, Washington, D.C., and elsewhere. We have the Metropolitan Opera HD transmissions to movie theaters. Opera is remarkably mediagenic, cameragenic. It really works because with multiple cameras, you can get up close, you can watch the singers in their wonderful acting ability, you get to see the physicality of their singing, the sound is fantastic. So opera's in the sweet spot of being really susceptible to transmission, radio, TV, HD transmissions. So it's really great that people can spend an evening at home on YouTube or go to the movies on Saturday and see the opera. On the other hand, all of these new means of access are competition for live performance. And I appreciate every level of access. I think the HD transmissions are great. I stay home sometimes in my pajamas with a glass of brandy in my hand, just playing with YouTube and watching singers. But opera, for me, happens best live and in the theater, where you're sitting elbow to elbow with people and your eye is free to look at the scenery, look at the chorus, look at the soloists, and you feel that great music not only in your ears but in your whole body as the theater resonates with a live sound. So opera is accessible in so many ways. For me, and I hope for others, it's best live at a performance in a theater.
Well, what do you think about opera in Iowa?
Well, opera in Iowa is remarkable to me. I know both Cedar Rapids Opera and Des Moines Metro Opera. And driving today, as I did from Omaha here to Cedar Rapids, I went through gorgeous countryside, beautiful rolling fields. And I felt deeply moved that the cities in this state, the two of them in particular, have established and support opera companies. And that in this community of Iowa, which is, you know, an educated community with industry, that despite the relatively small population, we have really wonderful opera in a summer festival in Des Moines and then here throughout the year in Cedar Rapids. It is a real tribute to the leaders in both of those communities that they have found the resources and have the community support to produce opera for appreciative audiences.
What's kind of interesting about both Cedar Rapids and Des Moines is that there was one person who had this vision and this dream and was able to build on it, and this is what's happening now.
If you look at the history of almost any opera company in the United States, thanks must be given to one driven leader. And certainly it's Robert Larson in Des Moines, it's Daniel Kleinknecht here in Cedar Rapids, of someone who is determined to bring opera to the community and who, frankly, is willing to work long hours and against the odds, because opera is really difficult. There are far easier ways to have a creative life than putting on opera. And these gentlemen really just wouldn't take no for an answer. Around the Opera America office, I always say no is just the slow way to yes. And these gentlemen absolutely embodied that sense of determination in order to express themselves through operas they wish to do, but also to share the transformative power of the art form with audiences who may be new to it. And it is their sacrifice and their determination that we have to appreciate for having these opera companies in this great state.
What do you see as the future of these companies and opera in Iowa and opera across the nation?
I was just at Opera Omaha, for instance, and they are about to celebrate their 60th anniversary and have real plans to expand beyond just the performances in their opera house to do some broader community activity using community artists, using an alternative venue, and embracing not only the traditional repertoire, but also some of the new American works that are being produced for big stages and for smaller spaces. In Des Moines, I think Michael's done a wonderful job of maintaining the company's history of a diverse repertoire, doing 20th and 21st century opera. And then all of his collaborative production work, Three Decembers with the theater company downtown, the performance of Rappaccini's Daughter at the Botanical Garden, and then this year doing the Winterreise at the museum, all of that kind of community work. And I think one of the current trends that I think is very promising for the future is that opera companies are keeping one foot in the opera house, but they're putting the other foot more deeply into the community to bring diverse work to alternative venues, to new venues, introducing opera to new audiences who may enjoy it outside of the opera house more than in the opera house. They're not giving up on traditional opera, but they're building beyond traditional opera. Here in Cedar Rapids, time flies, and the company is looking at its 20th anniversary in a couple of years, and there are some very exciting plans for that. Cedar Rapids Opera Theater has gone from being the brainchild of Daniel Klein-Kinect to being a real cultural asset for this community. So I'm visiting purposefully to be a part of that conversation because this company is imagining a long and bright future as it approaches its 20th year.
Mark Skorka, the president and CEO of Opera America. To hear more from Mark about Opera in America, please go to the drop-down classical menu and click on the iWard Showcase link on our website at iowapublicradio.org. A special thanks to the Cedar Rapids Opera Theater for opening up a spot on Mark's busy schedule for IPR. Coming up on January 13th and 15th, the Cedar Rapids Opera Theater will be presenting a double billing featuring Cavalleria Rusticana by Mascagni and Pagliacci by Leoncavallo. Don't go away. We'll delve into the Figge's unique exhibit called Giving the Devil His Due, featuring the genius of Paganini and Robert Johnson and showcasing the drawings and monotypes of Gary Kelly. And we'll head to Salisbury House in Des Moines to hear about their World War I concert and exhibition. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase. Salisbury House in Des Moines is hosting a program and pre-concert talk on November 10th. Dr. Megan Sybil, curator and historian at Salisbury House, and Dr. Eric Saylor, Drake's Associate Professor of Music History and the President of the North American British Music Studies Association, fill in the program details.
Salisbury House is a historic house museum. The museum was actually built as a private home in the 1920s by a gentleman named Carl Weeks. He and his wife Edith and their four boys lived in Salisbury House from the 1920s until the 1950s. And they had a very specific vision for Salisbury House. It looks as though you've sort of stepped back into 16th century England. It looks like this great old English manor house. The Iowa State Education Association then took charge of the property until the late 90s, at which point the Salisbury House Foundation, the nonprofit who runs the museum today, purchased the property from the teachers' union, and we've been open as a museum since then.
And you have this marvelous concert series, so tell us about the second concert in that series.
Well, there's some great music that's set up for this particular concert. We've decided to go with an all English composers that are associated with the First World War. Now, some of the composers who are on this concert actually fought in the Western Front in France and also in Greece. And a couple of the others were deeply affected by the war, by the conflict back in England, although they never participated themselves. So what the concert is trying to look at how the war affected these great transformations of music that were going on in England at the turn of the 20th century. And so we've got four different pieces on the program. We've got two pieces for tenor, piano, and string quartet. The first is by one of the greatest composers from Britain of the 20th century, Ralph Vaughan Williams, and it's called On Wenlock Edge. And the counterpart to that, again, also for tenor and string quartet and piano, is called Ludlow and Team, and it's written by Ivor Gurney. Now, both Vaughan Williams and Gurney fought in the First World War. Vaughan Williams fought on the Western Front. He was actually initially signed up with the Royal Ambulance Medical Corps. And he did this volunteering at the age of 42. He was well beyond the age of conscription, but wanted to go ahead and serve his country. So he started out there, later got transferred to Salonika in Greece, and then got moved back to France and put in charge of heavy artillery batteries. So he was in charge of 200 horses that were designed to drag around 40-pound howitzer guns around the field, and later took charge of the music directorship for the 1st Army of the British Expeditionary Force. Gurney, not quite so distinguished. He was an infantryman, fought on the Western Front in France between 1915 and 1917. 1917, he got shot, managed to get shell shock, and gassed all in one go at the Battle of Passchendaele, and then got repatriated to England after that. Went back to the Royal College of Music in London, where he studied with Vaughan Williams, and it's almost certain that upon hearing Vaughan Williams' own On Wenlock Edge at a concert in 1919, that he was inspired to write a piece that mimicked it very closely, not just in the instruments that are playing on it, but also in the texts that are used, because these are all songs. And the songs for both On Wenlock Edge and Ludlow and Team are set to texts by A.E. Houseman from his collection Shropshire Lad, which was very, very popular in the UK at the turn of the 20th century, and were really popular texts to set during wartime because of these very fatalistic, pessimistic kinds of texts that really seem to resonate with a lot of people. And the other two pieces that we got in the program are ones by people who stayed behind in England. One is a second violin sonata by a guy named John Ireland, who was a contemporary of Vaughan Williams's, went to school with him at the Royal College of Music, and wrote this second violin sonata shortly after the real disasters of the Somme in 1916. The piece was completed in 1917, hugely successful when it first came out, and was sort of immortalized by being performed by Albert Sammons and William Murdoch. These were two musicians who were also soldiers in the Grenadier Guards, and there are famous pictures of them performing this, both wearing their military khaki. The last piece on the program is a piano quartet by Herbert Howells, who was quite young at the time. He completed this work in 1916 when he was still a student at the Royal College of Music, but afterwards had it entered in a competition that won. It was a big new competition that allowed this recruitment of new composers to contribute to the Carnegie Collection of British Music. First time that such a competition had been held. So he's seen as this young wunderkind who is making this new splash into the world of professional music. The piece itself is dedicated to his very good friend, Ivor Gurney, who at the time was still fighting in France. And it's a little dedication to him because they grew up together in rural Gloucester. So it's both a tribute to his friend who was in the fields in France and also to the background friendship that they shared as children out in the West Country.
And then in conjunction with this, you have collaborated with the Gold Star Museum.
We were really thrilled to make this partnership work with Mike Vogt, who runs the Gold Star Military Museum up at Camp Dodge. Mike has been kind enough to loan us several artifacts from his collection that date to World War I. So we have pieces from the U.S. military side, from the German side, a couple of pieces from the British military as well. So it'll be a nice complement to the concert that we'll have available for viewing in the days leading up to the concert, at the event itself, and then afterwards as well, if folks want to come by and see these really special items from the Gold Star Museum.
Because, of course, the First World War is observing its centenary right now and has been for the last 2 years. We've still got two more to go. So next year marks the centenary of the American entry into the war. This year has recently marked the centenary of the Battle of the Somme, one of the most horrible battles of the entire conflict. And in 2 years, we'll actually get to the armistice. So we thought that this was a great opportunity to have all of these different threads come together in one memorializing session in a place in America that has such powerful links to the United Kingdom. And we're very indebted to the Gold Star Museum for being so heavily involved in providing us with tangible evidence of the conflict.
Tell us about your featured performers.
Well, we've got the Amara Quartet coming down from Ames. We also have Julie Fox Henson, who's going to be coming in as one of the augmenting violins for this. And we also have Edwin Griffith, who is our guest tenor, and he's going to be performing on both Ludlow and Team and Wenlock Edge. I believe that Julie is going to be doing the violin sonata and that the Amara Quartet is going to be doing all of the Howells as well as both Vaughan Williams and Gurney's pieces.
Dr. Eric Saylor, Drake's Associate Professor of Music History, and Dr. Megan Sybil, Curator and Historian at Salisbury House. The Salisbury House World War I Concert and Exhibit will be held on November 10th. Doors open at 6:45, with Dr. Saylor's pre-concert talk starting at 7 and the performance beginning at 7:30. Concert tickets may be purchased and more information found at salisburyhouse.org. To hear more about this special Salisbury House program from Megan and Eric's interview, please go to the drop-down classical menu and click on the Iowa Art Showcase link on our website at iowapublicradio.org. Please join Iowa Public Radio at 10 a.m. on Veterans Day for a special patriotic broadcast of the Des Moines Symphony's 4th of July Yankee Doodle Pops concert. At noon, IPR will present the Veterans Day special Salute and Song featuring the vocal ensemble Contus. Just ahead, Giving the Devil His Due, the art of Gary Kelly at the Figge. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase.
There was a time if somebody said, we'd like you to do a museum show, I would have tightened up and thought, well, I'd better do some really personal stuff and make it look very interesting, maybe hard to understand by everybody. I'm way past that now. You know, I accept who I am now at this point in my career, and I'm really enjoying it. And I don't care what a critic in Art News magazine might say about the fact that these are book illustrations. Yeah, they are, and I'm really proud of them.
I consider it an honor and a privilege every time I get to work with the folks at the Figge. They're top shelf all the way, and it's always an honor to work with them. I really enjoyed meeting Mr. Kelly, and I love the book. The imagery is perfect to go with the music. It's very haunting, and it's just got the right feel.
The exhibit really started when somebody told us about Gary Kelly and we should do a show with him. And then it sort of ended up being about these two books about musicians who sold their souls to the devil. So that's when we brought in Ellis and the symphony on it. And I think we were all just really impressed with the level of the artwork. And like Ellis says, the Robert Johnson, the feeling of those images versus the Paganini images, they're much more sort of Baroque, but they're equally well done. So it's just a fun way to take a different look at visual arts and music.
Iowa's own artist and illustrator, Gary Kelly, along with the director of programming and community outreach at Davenport's River Music Experience, Ellis Kell, and the Figge's executive director, Tim Schiffer. Gary Kelly grew up in Algona and received his art degree at the University of Northern Iowa and an honorary doctor of letters from UNI in 1995. As a member of the prestigious Society of Illustrators, Gary holds the record for receiving 27 gold and silver medals from the Society's annual New York exhibitions. In 2007, he was inducted into the Society of Illustrators Hall of Fame. Some of his clients have included Time, Atlantic Monthly, The New Yorker, and Playboy magazines, along with commissions by the National Football League, the National Basketball Association, Santa Fe Opera, the Kentucky Derby, and the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, to name a few. Kelly hand-created the famous author murals that embellish Barnes & Noble bookstores across the nation. He also produced large murals for the walls of the Google Data Center in Council Bluffs. Right now, he's working on a collaboration with the WCF Symphony and Jason Weinberger to create a new take on the Nutcracker using Duke Ellington's version. That unique concert happens on December 10th at UNI's Gallagher Bluedorn. His major book work started 25 years ago with Sleepy Hollow. Since then, he has created and published over 28 books. The Figge Art Museum approached him about an exhibition on two of his books, giving him the option to choose the ones he wanted to feature. Gary Kelly.
For me, it was a no-brainer because they're fairly recent books, The Dark Fiddler, the Paganini book, and Black Cat Bone, the Robert Johnson book, are both about musicians and composers, and they're in two different styles, and they're two different periods in musical history and history in general, two different continents. But when you start to research these two artists, Paganini and Robert Johnson, it's amazing how many things they have in common. And one of them being that they, in folklore at least, supposedly sold their souls to the devil. And so that was my touchstone right away. I mean, I've always been fascinated by that kind of folklore and those kind of stories. And I thought, well, this has to be the pairing for the show. It's got to be Black Cat Bone and Dark Fiddler. So we took it from there.
How did you select which pieces that you were going to hang or be part of this show?
Well, when I saw the space, I have to admit, I was intimidated. It's a beautiful museum. I mean, this is a serious art museum. And the ceilings in my gallery, they're probably 20 feet high. There are a lot of very big white walls and then options for movable walls. And so it was a little intimidating, but at the same time, I had plenty of space for every piece in the book. So the two books featured here, the exhibition includes every original illustration, framed and matted, that appeared in those books. And then we still had some space left over, so to speak. And I filled that with 15 additional pieces of my work based on the music that speaks to me, a musical theme or that I had done for musical clients like Rolling Stone magazine or somebody like that. And the biggest piece in the show is an oil painting on canvas that I just did for a show I had in Illinois a few years ago based on the blues. And it's a painting that I created from drawings and some photographs I shot at the Mississippi Valley Blues Festival in the park in Davenport. And it was of an old blues man at the tent stage. And everything was so accessible in that situation. I could take my camera and my sketchbook and go backstage. And so I did a painting of Robert Jr. Lockwood, who was there that year, and this had to be early 90s maybe. And he was actually Robert Johnson's stepson. He lived with Robert Johnson and his wife when he was a boy. So I thought, well, here's a direct line to Robert Johnson, which I picked up on in Davenport, Iowa. And I thought, here's a chance to share it again.
Well, you were talking about this big wall space. You did some pretty amazing artwork on the wall directly. Tell us about that.
Well, part of this exhibition concept that we developed working with the Figge, and especially Andrew Wallace, my main connection down there, was to maybe create some additional works specifically for the space. So it was a 20-foot white wall. It's pretty intimidating when you start to do a black chalk or a charcoal freehand drawing on it, graffiti basically. And in this situation, you couldn't project a sketch on the wall and just redraw it. It had to be literally spontaneous. So I spent probably at least 2 days of my week installation time down there drawing these large, kind of gnarly line drawings, one of Paganini on one side of the entrance to the gallery and Robert Johnson on the other side. And I suppose the figures themselves are 10 feet high, maybe. It was a really interesting and enjoyable experience. And then to finish it, when we had everything basically hung in the galleries, there were two additional walls at the back of the gallery that seemed kind of blank. I mean, they had art in the middle, but the two sides weren't really right for framed art. So I thought, part of what really I think I was saying with this exhibition was where my musical tastes wander, and they are varied, but one sound I always come back to is Jimi Hendrix. Kind of grew up with him. And if I had to go away somewhere and have only one track to listen to, it would be All Along the Watchtower by Jimi Hendrix, which of course was written by our new laureate, Bob Dylan. So I want Hendrix to be part of this exhibition because he's a small part of it. But to me, he embodies a lot of the same things that Robert Johnson and Niccolo Paganini do. He had the performance persona on stage of Paganini. I mean, this strange, crazy figure. And he is rooted in the blues like Robert Johnson. So I really wanted to sneak him into the exhibition somehow, although it's not about him. And so those two walls that were remaining, I, at the last minute, pulled up some photos of Hendrix on my wife's phone, and I found the hands that I wanted, and so I drew Jimi Hendrix's hands, very, very large. I don't know how many people will realize whose hands they are, but they mean something to me.
How many monotypes? Is that what you have?
Right. Yeah, the Black Cat Bone Book was created with the printmaking process called monotype. And you paint an image on plexiglass with an oil-based etching ink. That's what I use. And then dampen a piece of good paper and crank it through a press, and you can lift off one repeat image. Maybe a ghost, they call it a second image if you're lucky. And I just felt like back when I did the Robert Johnson book, that's almost 10 years ago now, I thought that technique, that style, because it's prone to accidents and it's very organic, I thought that really fit kind of the vibe of the Delta blues and country blues, Mississippi in the 1930s. And that's what this book is all about, really, the music in that situation. So I've used that a lot since, too. I mean, I've done a lot of projects with monotype, and I love the medium.
And you have a lot of symbolism that carries through both of these series that you put together.
For me, it's really important and really enjoyable to work elements into an image that maybe everybody won't understand, or maybe will be a little provocative, like, why is that there? But if it makes sense to me and my interpretation of the story, or it enhances the backstory that involves the image, then I'm totally happy with it. I mean, that's what I want. Not antagonize at all, but maybe sometimes, but not usually, but provoke. And I want people to realize that there's way more to this process than just finding a picture you want to copy or a picture you want to make up and then draw it. There's so many more things that go into it than that, for me anyway. And that's why books are so much fun to do, because I have pretty much, I'd say, almost total control in these books as far as the imagery goes. So I can do anything I want like that within a certain amount of reason, of course. And so that makes books so much fun for me to do. They keep me grounded and alive creatively with what they have to offer.
Well, with Robert Johnson, with him in the coffin, and then you have this black cat, sort of his image up on top of the whole picture, and then the black cat that carries through the whole thing is just really incredible.
Well, both of these books were my ideas. That's the joy of working with this publisher, Creative Editions. First of all, they produce beautiful books, absolutely the best quality standards. They also, 90% of the time, they buy into my pitches to them. And I did Black Cat Bone before I did Paganini, but that story has always been intriguing to me. And to tell the story with monotypes, and then the title for the book, Black Cat Bone, is my title. It's not my term. It's a voodoo term. It's a blues term. But it doesn't speak directly to any story or anything I've ever read or heard from Robert Johnson that doesn't really speak to black cats much at all. I mean, Black Cat Bone is a legitimate term from the era and the music, but Robert Johnson, it wasn't one of his touch points. But as a relevant term to the music and the period, I just thought it sounded good. So that was the reason that the black cat is a recurring theme. There are cats in the Paganini book as well. I'm not a cat lover. I'm more of a dog person. But going all the way back to Sleepy Hollow, there's a recurring cat in that book, a black cat. It adds to a mood, I think. If you want to darken the mood a little bit or add mystery, a black cat's a good way to do it.
And I love the picture of when Virginia died. That is so beautiful with the shooting star.
Yeah, the night Virginia died, I think, is the name of that verse. And Pat Lewis wrote all of these verses, my favorite collaborator, J. Patrick Lewis. And a lot of it's based on lyrics. But that falling star, it's a bad omen in the Delta culture of that era. And it often meant somebody in the household, their days were numbered. And so that's why I chose to put it. It's not just a graphic device. And little tidbits like that, which I didn't know until I started digging deeper into the story of the culture, not just Robert Johnson. Those are things I love to find out. And I really like to share those, whether everybody understands them or not. If 10% of my readers will say, well, nah, that guy did his homework, then I'm happy.
And Paganini was known for his very long, skinny fingers, and he seemed to work those in too.
Yeah, his physique was part of what drew me to the story, I have to admit. And it also changed the way I was looking at my work and the way I was drawing at that point. That book might have been 2008 or 9. And most of my books up to that point had been created with a little bit different feel to the composition and the way the figure or the landscape was interpreted by me. When I started to wade into Paganini, I don't know where it came from, but I know it came from just the fact that I'm addicted to my books and my art history and everything. But the shot just came out of the blue in my studio one day that the perfect person to illustrate a story about Paganini would have been the Austrian artist Egon Schiele. He lived a century later, and he's Austrian, he's not Italian, but his figures always looked so tortured and so wiry and so gnarly, and he used a lot more line work than I was using at the time, although I always felt confident in my line work. And so I thought, I'm going to do this book with a definite nod to Egon Schiele. And it turned out to just totally energize me around that story, because Schiele and Paganini, to me, are the perfect match. And so that's where that came from. And I sort of gave my permission to let my drawing show through in my work more than it had up to that point. And I've always loved drawing, so I'm still doing it that way. I mean, the latest books I've made have still been leaning on Schiele.
Artist and illustrator Gary Kelly. In conjunction with Gary's exhibit, several community partners are celebrating Gary Kelly's Giving the Devil His Due on Thursday, November 17th at the Figgy with a night of dance, visual arts, and music. They'll include performances of works by Robert Johnson and Paganini. The Figgy's executive director, Tim Schiffer, outlines the performers, and River Music Experience's Ellis Kell tells us about the amazing talents of Robert Johnson.
Robert Johnson, you know, he was such a crucial part of the Delta Blues, considered the king of the Delta Blues, and he was such a unique performer, and then the whole mystique of him trading his soul to the devil for musical talent, that was a really well-known legend back down in the Delta, that people thought you could make a deal with the devil at midnight at the crossroads for love or fortune or whatever. So it wasn't just Robert Johnson, but his music transcended the ages and influenced everyone from Eric Clapton to the Rolling Stones. And this was a guy that died by the early 1930s, recorded 29 songs in two different sessions, and there's people still playing them, and his stuff is still as vital today as it ever was. And I think Robert Johnson will always be regarded as the king of the Delta Blues. He was the real deal. He drew from other artists early on, but he also had his own style. He had this real high-pitched, eerie vocal style that very few ever came close to. His range was incredible. His vocal range was incredible. And he was a good singer. You know, he was dead on pitch. But he had this high vocal range and then this guitar playing where he played rhythm and bass and lead all at the same time. And people are still trying to figure out how he did it today. Eric Clapton recorded the album Me and Mr. Johnson, where I think he probably worked harder than anybody to emulate his style, because he wanted to present it, not me playing Sweet Home Chicago, but this is the way Robert played it. And it's tough. I can't do it. I've tried to play like him, and it's just, he was a master and developed his own style.
So what are you going to play on November 17th?
I'm honored to be a part of this. Gary Kelly's book is fabulous, and it goes with the music and the legend of Robert Johnson so well. I mean, it's just a perfect fit. So what I'll probably do is I want to bring an old Gibson that I have, a small-bodied Gibson, which would have been similar to the kind of guitar Robert played. And we'll probably tune it up in an open tuning so we can get that high-pitched ring. And then I also want to bring a dobro and play some slide, because that's so central to the feeling of the blues and the texture of the blues. So just mix in between those things. But it'll be all acoustic. May throw a little harmonic in, because Robert would pair up with people. You know, he would pair up with Willie Brown or one of the harmonica players from time to time. And just a little bit of everything, but it'll be mostly all Delta acoustic blues.
Well, tell us a little bit about your feelings on this exhibit and then this wonderful thing that you've got going on the 17th.
To bring somebody like Gary in, who really is a master, and he spoke to the Creative Arts Academy students in Davenport, and, you know, for them to meet somebody who is that accomplished, but who's kind of a multi-talented person, you know, with music and writing and the visual arts, it's fun.
Who else is going to be joining Ellis on this event?
So, Naha Greenholz, she's the concertmaster for the Quad City Symphony, will be at the Figge that night. And so she will be doing violin pieces. I'm assuming pieces that Paganini might have played in his time as a virtuoso. And then the Quad Cities Ballet will be there, and they'll be doing something on the theme. I'm not quite sure whether it's Paganini theme or Robert Johnson theme.
And how do folks get more information and tickets and that sort of thing?
Well, you don't need a ticket. It's free. It's Thursday night, November 17th. Starts at 5:30, and you just show up.
The Figge's Executive Director, Tim Schiffer, along with the Director of Programming and Community Outreach at Davenport's River Music Experience, Ellis Kell. To hear more about Gary Kelly's exhibit and work, please go to the drop-down classical menu and click on the iWard Showcase link on our website at iowapublicradio.org. Gary Kelly also has the exhibit 25 Years, The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, the original book illustrations, on display at the Hearst Center for the Arts in Cedar Falls through November 27th. For more details on Veterans Day and Thanksgiving Day IPR special broadcasts, be sure to check out iowapublicradio.org. Today's November Iowa Art Showcase broadcast is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Program thanks to this show goes to Julia Bullard, Mark Skorka, Megan Sybil, Eric Saylor, Gary Kelly, Ellis Kell, and Tim Schiffer. Production thanks goes to Iowa Public Radio's Tony Daner, Phil Moss, John Pemble, and Chris Fenton. Program research was provided by Rachel Berenger, Nick Schumacher, Karen Impla, and Mark Simmet. I'm Jacqueline Hallbloom. Thanks for joining us. For more information on Iowa Public Radio's programming schedule and Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase, please visit our website at iowapublicradio.org. ¶¶